Matt Richtel is an author and New York Times reporter who's been pretty busy of late. The Inner Pandemic, an examination of American teens' mental health, spread out across a series of articles reported with pathos and a stunning depth, has been rolling out during the past few months. It covers a range of social and physical changes this generation's currently dealing with. But Richtel's also recently published a book called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, where he interrogates the spark of creation. I'm Dave Cantor, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Warning before we get started today. This episode contains mentions of suicide and self-harm. You are Matt Richtel, author and New York Times reporter who recently has published a series called The Inner Pandemic, an examination of American teens' mental health. You've also got a recently released book out called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. There's a lot that I think is interrelated and a lot to get through here, but I think you have a couple kids. So were you thinking about their well-being kind of, and that's what led to the series?
Remarkably, no, because I was thinking about their well-being, but the series called The Inner Pandemic, which has to do with changing risk faced by adolescence, actually began for me more than 3 years ago. I started to wonder about mental health and young people, having heard from peer parents, having read some statistics, but it wasn't really until the beginning of 2021 that I saw a series of statistics that had me thinking it was time and that we had a linchpin. May I just hit what those statistics are? Because they're not precisely what I imagined they would be or what others may think. It wasn't enough to spend nearly 2 years of the New York Times energy and time and resources to remark that there is a mental health crisis among young people. We sort of knew that anxiety and depression and self-harm had been on the rise. What clinched it for me was when I saw two related sets, or maybe not related, two sets of data. One showed that those were all going up, but the other showed that since I had been a young person in the 80s, the public health harms that vexed my generation, drunk driving, binge drinking, cigarette smoking, teenage pregnancy, and illicit drugs had all gone down. And in point of fact, what really spurred us forward into a series that is only just begun, the rest of this year we will be writing it, is that there has been a transformational shift in the risk faced by adolescents, from those external harms to the internal harms of anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, self-harm, and suicide.
At one point, a psychologist talks about the numbers you're referencing and says the substance abuse numbers are decreasing because people aren't around each other. It's a pandemic. So peer pressure doesn't function the same way at a distance. But did other people kind of characterize how or why that's happening?
Yeah. I mean, this is, again, why we spent so much time, and we're still in the middle. Over the next few months, you will see a series more in this series. But the reason we spent so much time is this is a, as I've said even just a few seconds ago, a transformational shift. And to understand the sociology and the science has taken a lot of time. But at its core is a lifestyle shift that has been led by technology. but it is not the same as technology. And the distinction I draw there, and it's a significant one, is that it's not like social media or video games or streams of bad news alone is contributing to these mental health issues. Rather, those are all a subset of a vast lifestyle change led by technology that has people interacting in a radically different way than my generation interacted.
Yeah, this seems like an adaptability thing that we haven't quite figured out yet as humans.
And we hadn't really figured out the last part either, because when we convened, I think you're too young. You guys don't know, but I'm looking at you right now. I think you're too long. But do you remember the Woodsy?
No, not at all.
You don't remember the term the Woodsy. So in my generation, here in Boulder, Colorado, where I'm spending the summer and grew up, we would get together for the Woodsy on Friday night. Someone put a keg down in the woods and we got together and we drove to the Woodsy. And then it started with spin the bottle. And this I didn't participate in, but given the statistics, I can promise you there were cigarettes and there were probably drugs. And when the spin in the bottle started, it led to other things. But that congregant behavior led to all those other ills that public health was petrified about. So to say we had figured that out is not exactly right. As we've moved indoors with our devices, or our kids have, my children's generation now, they're less likely to be around the keg using the drugs of the congregant drugs. It's much harder to have premarital sex if you're not physically with somebody. But there's a lot of loneliness and isolation and a whole bunch of information coming at young people that they're not working off in pastoral ways.
So just for context, I definitely grew up before smartphones, but had a Commodore 64 and a Game Boy, both things that were not around in 1983.
You were really between these generations, and you actually probably were in a particularly healthy dip in both areas.
In a number of these stories, you talk to families who obviously are not identified for a number of reasons. But how did you make contact with them and approach them about being part of these stories? Because the things that they talk to you about are so personal and just kind of devastating in a shocking way.
Yeah, I do want to say perhaps an odd thing, but I want to offer an immense amount of thanks to these families. I contacted them through people who had heard of a person who had heard of a person. Some people wrote into the New York Times. Somebody I'd interviewed for 2 months said, you know, this might be a better person. But the revelations, to your point, are extraordinary. You'll when you read this series, if you choose to, you will hear a father talk about the last words spoken by his suicidal daughter. You will hear the grief of children grappling with incredible internal pain, self-harming, suicide, falling in love with virtual characters online, the grief of parents saying, we're doing everything right. The grief of emergency room doctors sharing their stories of helplessness as thousands of kids now spend the night, each night in emergency room departments who are suicidal because there are no inpatient beds. Why did they share so much with us? In a way, this is journalism 101. I was given permission by the Times to spend endless hours, as much time as was needed, weeks and weeks in person, on the phone, on Zoom. And that's how trust gets created. And I hope that we have earned their trust and represented them fairly in these stories.
One of the stories is called Hundreds of Suicidal Teens Sleep in Emergency Rooms Every Night. And at the beginning of the story, you say there are 15 children sleeping in a Boston ER because there wasn't room at a nearby mental health facility. So, number one, that's just a shocking number. But is that the norm or was that an outlier?
Excuse me for interrupting, but far from being an outlier, we found statistics in that story, recent research out of Dartmouth, in excess of 1,000 young people a night in urban centers and rural areas that have been shown by other research, every night in the United States, in excess of 1,000 and maybe upwards of 4,000 young people in emergency rooms because there are no inpatient beds. And they must be kept there because they are a safety risk, mostly to themselves and maybe to others. That is a startling indictment of the following. As the risk to adolescents has shifted, our medical system has failed to keep up. Now, I will say this in fairness to the system. This has happened overnight. The lifestyle changes have been in less than a decade. So transforming a system that used to treat children with antibiotics for earaches and broken bones at Little League games for suicide and self-harm is asking a lot. And we have got to catch up and fast.
There's another story. Teens in distress are swamping pediatricians. And for this one, you're in a town in Kentucky, and there's a general practitioner who ostensibly functions as kind of mental health support and is prescribing drugs for mental health issues. So has anyone talked about the training, how training is going to change? So while a decade's a short amount of time, expectations seem like they need to be shifted pretty dramatically.
That's exactly what's happening right now. And we've seen even in response to the series, some real efforts to begin to assess this. You mentioned the use of drugs, and without giving too much, you'll see some significant revelations in this series in the coming weeks about the excessive reliance on medications to try to quell this problem in lieu of more broader solutions. I do want to hit on one point, though, that it would be negligent not to mention, and that's a biological factor at play. Would it be okay if I just got into, I mentioned the lifestyle, but really this story is about the collision of lifestyle and biology. And it would be short-sighted of me in this interview not to mention the biology piece. Can I hit on that?
Absolutely.
So think about adolescence like this. 150 years ago, it was a pretty short experience. You hit puberty. Your family said, and I'm oversimplifying, but your family said, you want to work at the farm or the factory? And which of these two people do you want to marry? Suddenly, you're an adult. Well, now what's happened is, because of a complex economy and to some extent a bunch of privilege, adolescence has elongated. But a curious thing has happened. Puberty has been falling. In the year 1900, puberty hit at the age of 14 for girls and roughly a year later for boys. It's always a little tougher to measure in boys because it's measured in girls by menstruation. But now puberty hits in girls at the age of 12. And the reasons for that are complicated. We don't fully know. It might have to do with nutrition, artificial light, but it's immaterial for this conversation. As puberty dips, or rather when puberty hits, it sets off immense sensitivity to social and hierarchical information. Why? Because it is preparing the brain to be for the creature, the organism, the adolescent, to go from being cared for to caring for others in a social world. Who am I and who am I in relation to others? But here's the catch. 150 years ago, when puberty hit at 14 or 15, the rest of the brain had already developed more fully. When puberty hits at 12, the parts of the brain that involve logic and making sense of all that social information have not developed yet. Now, guess what? Onslaught of information from technology, big lifestyle change. The brain is slammed with competitive information. What school am I going to go to? Where do I fit in athletically? Can I compete with all these people from all over the internet? And you start to get brains shutting down. And in a certain way, in a perverse and horrible way, self-harm, anxiety, depression, even suicidal ideation, they can be seen as coping mechanisms for this onslaught and mismatch of neurology.
Hey, just wanted to cut in here for a second and say that if you've got any questions, comments, or even ideas for future interviews, feel free to email me at knowledge@wamc.org or send us a message on Twitter or at tbookknowledge. That's T-B-O-O knowledge. Part of this, there's a race element to this. In one of the stories, there's a statistic that says from 1991 to 2017, suicides by Black adolescents rose 73% compared with an 18% rise among white adolescents. So whatever other issue society is dealing with, that seems like a number that would kind of stop anyone cold. I was going to say that there's probably a number of contributing factors, but that range of years doesn't even include the pandemic. I imagine that if there was this kind of trajectory over time, that it hasn't declined. So can you break that number down or give it context?
It's a shocking number, and I can't give too much away because we have a story forthcoming about that issue, and I don't want to. I'm glad you asked, and I'm glad you pointed it out. But it is particularly of note because it's a demographic that for whom suicide was not a big issue, and it appears that there are at least two factors in play. One is the microaggression thing. And the other thing is that and I'm not going to go too much into it here, but as you've seen Black families rise and become upwardly mobile, some of the factors that are protective for white families are not so protective for Black families because of the microaggressions that occur. And readers can see a bit of that with one of the stories that's already run in this young woman in Minnesota who committed suicide. Her father is a surgeon at the Mayo Clinic, and he suffered some terrible racism before her very eyes. But again, I want to withhold too much here because you'd be a fine New York Times editor in saying, Matt, you got to do more about this, and I will.
We obviously don't know what the end of the pandemic is going to look like, but when we get there, do the kinds of stories you're telling change? What changes?
I don't think so. I think this is a pre-pandemic phenomenon. You look at it growing around 2007, intensifying during the pandemic, perhaps because some of these lifestyle factors were amplified. But I wouldn't. This is not a pandemic story. Full stop. It's another reason why we invested so much time and energy in it, because we are looking at a transformation in the risks to young people that predates the pandemic, and if we don't do anything, is going to extend well beyond it.
I believe you worked with photographer Annie Flanagan on the series. So what's it like working with a visually minded person while you're reporting, and do they offer you insights that you don't think you would have kind of landed on otherwise?
First off, Annie's a godsend. They are an amazing set of eyes and an amazing set of ears. It so happened that this was an unusual story and we were not often together. We traveled at different times. Part of that has to do with the sensitivity of a topic. It can be hard to, and this is inside baseball, and I don't know if your listeners are inclined to hear it, but just my stock and trade over many years at the New York Times has been doing long form, oftentimes highly emotionally charged journalism. And it can be really counterproductive to bring a photographer in at the beginning of an experience like that, because it's intimidating enough to have an intimate conversation with a stranger without someone pointing a camera in your face. The beauty of having a visual person, especially one as talented as Annie, is twofold. One, they act as a second set of ears and eyes when they go back and spend time with these subjects. But the second is, I am so visually inept. Years ago, I wrote a syndicated comic strip and I had someone illustrate it for me, because so poor are my illustrations that my stick figures look like circles. So it's really helpful to have a visual person when you're a word person.
Before we started recording, I asked you about any connections between the series and the book, Inspired Understanding Creativity. And it seems like there must have been an overlap in time when you were working in working on both.
My process starts with authenticity. And creativity, in its essence, is an act of authenticity. And writing about young people and getting them to share is an act of being vulnerable myself and asking vulnerability of them. And I think that's where creativity and honesty and candor and truth and real policy all come from. So in that respect, there's a fundamental process overlap between reporting something as grueling and grief-stricken as adolescent mental health and something as uplifting as it is to me, and I hope will be to readers, as a book about creativity. In fact, I've said more than once, I know it's really fashionable to have bad news these days, but I tried to write a good news book.
For Inspired, you talk a bit about the myth of the creative genius, but I think you find it more realistic to credit groups spurring bursts of creativity and artistic advancement. So how did you arrive at that conclusion, and what were the kind of models you were looking at?
Well, this is a book that, so this book is called Inspired, and I really wanted to understand at a core this sensation that I experience and that I know so many people experience, where they go, oh my gosh, I have an idea. I have got to do something with that. Over the years, I would hear from great creators, famous creators, friends, not so famous creators, people sitting on the couch. What is that? How fundamental is it to the species? And so I started the story in a place where a lot of people associate with creation, which is Jerusalem. And it was actually happenstance that from Jerusalem, I learned a lot of fascinating science that ultimately is the foundation of the book. And the science I learned was, I think of Jerusalem. I don't know what you think about Jerusalem, but I think of it as a company town, and the town is religion. And all these crazy, incredible, I don't mean crazy, by crazy, I mean, crazy is a word I use with glee. Wonderful ideas about creation came out of this place. You know what was so powerful about Jerusalem? It wasn't that it was filled with geniuses. It's that it was big. 500,000 people lived in Jerusalem, which was a big number for the time. And as you go down the list of creative hubs, Florence, places in Russia, Paris, Harlem, they become these congregations of like-minded people pushing and cooperating and collaborating. And then you start to go even deeper into the science, and you realize that the mere size of a city begins to grow the number of ideas that come out of that place. So as much as we want to say there's a creative genius, there's got to be a lot of people working together to lead to that person.
Within this context, there's a regular mode of thinking, and then people are spurred to these creative bursts of advancement. The phrase out of the box appears pretty frequently in the book, and sometimes you use it in quotes, seemingly to denote its overuse. Do you think the phrase has factored into the myths promoted around creativity?
Yeah, I'm not going to get too hung up on it, because I think there's a matter of substance that you brought up there that's really important. And the matter of substance has to do with, what is the creative thought? What does it feel like? So if we set aside the language, the idea of a creative thought is something that is novel and has some value. And I want to be really clear about the term value. Value doesn't mean cure cancer. Value can mean something as simple as, I walked into the kitchen and there were three ingredients, and the children were starving, and I came up with something and that no one had ever put together before, or I was not aware of it. That can be a creative thought. To go a step further, when people think out of the box, Could I go into the neuroscience a bit of creativity to get at what this means?
Yeah, please do.
Inside your brain, very broadly, when it comes to creativity, there are a couple of networks. One is the rigid analytical part of your brain that I'll call the box. And this is the part of your brain that tends to dwell on ideas and think about rules and is incredibly valuable in so many respects. But the part that's out of the box is this part of that's almost subconscious. It's the part where an idea strikes you when you're on a run or in the shower, or if you prefer this really evocative image of it, I believe it was both Thomas Edison and Picasso used to do the following thing. They would take a nap and they'd have a rock or other heavy object in their hand. And as they fell asleep, the object would drop from their hand and wake them, and they'd find themselves with a thought. And then that thought would get run over the rugged analytical part of the brain to see if it had any value. But that thought came, if you will, from out of the box, out of the logical, rigid terrain of the prefrontal cortex. That's what out of the box means to me. And that's the place we're looking to derive our ideas from. And they can't come from mere will alone.
Last question. And this is something that I ask everyone who comes on the show. Is there an interaction with a teacher or mentor that sticks out in your mind as kind of having set you on the path that you've been following?
I'm going to give you a weird answer to this question. And you've probably had a lot of weird answers. In my 20s, I had a collapse. And it was a time when I needed to learn to listen to myself. I wound up going in the midst of this to a therapist and asking what was wrong with me. And over about an 18-month period, this person had some ideas. And the more I listened to this person, the more I began to realize that only I had the answers to what was vital to me. And so one of the most vital relationships was not what someone told me. It was me recognizing that someone who thought they knew better than I did had no business telling me what was better for me than what I know to be true for myself. And out of that came the creator you see today.
I don't know if that's the weirdest one, but maybe the most non-education related. I mean, self-realization is a kind of education, I suppose. But yeah, definitely unique response. That's all we've got for this edition of the show. I'm the host and producer of The Best of Our Knowledge, Dave Cantor, and our theme music, this and every week, is a track called Musical Chairs by LA producer Omid Valizadeh. A link to his SoundCloud page is in the show notes. You can find The Best of Our Knowledge online at wamc.org and on just about any app you can think of, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Pocket Casts. So go ahead, subscribe, and join us next week for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.